This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
The presidential transition. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
As of this month, the Trump and Clinton campaigns are already working on transition planning from the Obama administration. Find out how that works.
Ford is the latest company to announce its accelerating plans for self-driving cars. What will autonomous vehicles eventually mean for our daily lives?
The random habits of Olympic athletes that the rest of us could adopt to be more successful.
And why golf courses seem so empty these days.
For the past 5 years, the golf industry has seen kind of a slow in growth, both in participation and private club memberships. And that's been a factor, or it's been caused by a variety of factors.
Market Watch reporter Katie Burke on what's up with golf. She's here later in the hour. The campaigns of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton already are at work on transition planning from the administration of President Obama, aided by a series of laws passed in recent years that give candidates a head start on the process. For the past 2 weeks, transition teams for Mr. Trump and Mrs. Clinton have had access to a workspace in a nondescript government office building near the White House. It's a story from Wall Street Journal White House correspondent Byron Tao. Byron, what about security briefings?
Because this is classified, we don't know a ton about it. What we do know is that these briefings tend to be very broad. They tend to be overviews of threats that the United States faces. They do not include sort of operational details. They don't include the nitty-gritty of intelligence programs. These are just sort of general overviews to prepare whoever is the president come January for the task ahead.
All right, so how much information, I guess, with regards to security briefings would, say, Mrs. Clinton or Mr. Trump get? Are they exposed to everything now?
Yeah, so because this is classified, we don't know a ton about it. What we do know is that these briefings tend to be very broad. They tend to be overviews of threats that the United States faces. They do not include sort of operational details. They don't include the nitty-gritty of intelligence programs. These are just sort of general overviews to prepare whoever is the president come January for the task ahead.
Wow. All right. So is there at least like a two-page document for Mr. Trump on Russia, Ukraine, Crimea? No, I'm kidding. How awkward can it be, though, when especially given the nature of what's been said among certain candidates at this point?
Well, what's interesting, actually, speaking of awkward, is that the Trump and Clinton transition teams, if they take advantage of the government office space, will be literally sharing the same space.
Wow.
So they'll be in the same office preparing for parallel efforts to elect their person. And they'll literally be sitting on top of each other and next to each other as they prepare different efforts for who will take over in January. But it is true that Donald Trump has come under a lot of criticism this week and last week and this month over a number of foreign policy issues, including Ukraine, including appearing to encourage Russia to hack Hillary Clinton's emails. So there have been some calls to restrict his access to classified information, but the folks in the government say that that's not in their power, that all candidates get the same information, and that's just how it is.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal White House correspondent Byron Tao. He's got a story called Behind Chaotic Presidential Campaign, Work Begins for Smooth Transition. So this was not the case years ago, right? It used to be just done by the seat of candidates' pants, right, past Election Day.
That's right. There were very few laws governing transition before 1960, and even since then, there wasn't much in the way of formal guidance or formal procedures for candidate transitions. A lot of that changed in the post-9/11 world, where concerns about security, concerns about terrorist attacks at events like inauguration, where the handoff of power happens, really came into the forefront, and security planners decided that we need a much more orderly way to do this to ensure that the handoff between governments is successful. And so after 9/11, a series of laws were passed giving candidates access to government workspace, giving them access to basically staff and resources to ensure that they have the team in place to hit the ground running from day one.
Is there material, say, in some of these briefings that one candidate might be able to use against the other? And I'm thinking specifically Mr. Trump. Might he see something that says, wow, I could use this on the campaign trail. I'm going to tie Hillary Clinton to this that happened with the Obama administration.
So intelligence officials emphasize the fact that, again, these are sort of very broad security overviews. There won't be much in the way of operational details or, it won't delve deep into, say, Hillary Clinton's record on Libya or the Obama administration's record there. So these are just sort of big, broad overviews. And, yeah, they may include some classified material and assessments, but by and large, they tend to be very broad and lacking on the specific details that could embarrass anyone.
There was, I think, one line in the story where it talked about this being the largest, perhaps, and most important transition of any entity anywhere, right? Business, government, whatever.
That's right. I mean, if you think about it, the federal government has a budget of several trillion dollars. It has several million employees. It has armed forces. It has nuclear weapons. And the way that we transition between one president and another has been very ad hoc. You know, corporations where a lot less is at stake do a much better job of leadership transitions compared to the government. So this has been a real area of bipartisan focus over the past few years to really improve the way we do things, and I think this will be the first time since these new laws have come into place that they'll be used. Mitt Romney took advantage of them, but of course lost. So this is the first sort of peaceful transfer of power that's happening under this new set of laws, and so we'll see how it goes, but all indications are that it will work smoother than in previous years.
Thanks, Byron. Wall Street Journal White House correspondent Byron Tao. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
In business, risks and rewards come with every decision, like moving to the cloud with Office 365. While its benefits include anywhere access and lower costs, cyber threats and user errors can quickly wipe out data and the money you save. Barracuda Essentials for Office 365 provide an added layer of security and functionality for threat protection, email migration, data recovery, and quality of service. Move securely to Office 365. Visit Barracuda.com/essentials to learn more.
Looking for the next place to grow or expand your business? Why not look to a state that's one of America's top 10 for business, where 2,000 burdensome regulations were eliminated over the past 5 years and is now home to the sixth best entrepreneurial climate? All this and more awaits you in the state of Michigan, the state that should be the number one choice for your business. Go to MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. Again, that's MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. Hey, glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. Here's something we've all done and have probably done with lousy results. And that's when someone is stressed out, we say at the office, hey, relax. Well, apparently that has the exact opposite effect for people who are stressed out. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
Has anyone ever told you to relax when you're really upset about something? That one word probably made you want to blow a gasket. Sue Schellenbarger of the Wall Street Journal explains why telling someone to relax actually has the opposite effect. Sue, why is relax the wrong thing to say?
It comes across as condescending. Generally, it's telling somebody not to feel what they're feeling, to tamp down their feelings. And research shows that when you try to suppress an emotion, it just comes out that much stronger. Stress is something you just can't turn around on a dime. It takes at least 20 to 60 minutes to relax after you're highly stressed. So it really just makes things worse.
20 to 60 minutes or 40 minutes, whatever you said, that sounds like an awfully long time to relax. Is that true?
The body can tense up, the blood vessels dilate, the blood pressure rises, heart rate increases very quickly. We've all experienced this in response to some fearful challenge or frightening development or threat. What happens, though, as the body calms down is much slower physiologically to have the blood vessels relax, expand, blood pressure decline, heart rate come down. We all have experienced this after a hard workout. It takes a little while for your body to get back to a normal metabolic state.
Okay, suppose you are the person who has received this relax or calm down thing. What should you do with it?
Try not to take it personally, which is really hard. Stop, take a deep breath, and ask yourself, okay, can I get at the source of this? What is the problem? If you can use it as a pivot to turn and talk about the cause and say something like, yeah, I'm really racing to hit this deadline we set. I wonder if we could all get together next week and talk about whether we could ease the stress on the whole team by easing the deadline up a little bit. Or sometimes you need to take a look in the mirror and see if maybe you're making life harder for yourself or spreading secondhand stress to others. Maybe you're being too perfectionistic, and that can be causing the same problem.
You mentioned this in the context of the workplace. Is this something that people hear in the workplace often?
I think bosses will sometimes just be annoyed by somebody who's obviously stressed. They might just feel bad themselves and want the person to stop. A narcissistic boss might just want it to go away. Other bosses might blame themselves and say that, you know, if I were a better manager, this wouldn't be happening. So they stomp over and say, relax. And in other cases, the boss may be genuinely afraid that this stress will spread to colleagues. Emotions in the workplace are contagious.
We're speaking with Sue Schellenbarger, The Wall Street Journal, about why you shouldn't tell someone to relax. Sue, what should you say instead?
If your interest isn't genuinely being helpful, approach the person in a calm, measured way yourself and say, hey, how's it going? Or it looks like you're having a tough day. And, you know, talk to me about what's going on. Or would you like to take a break? Take a walk, or would you like to work from home for a day? If you really want to help the person relax first and then set yourself up to address the problem. If you don't feel like doing that and you're the boss or someone else on the job, take a calm moment and take the person aside and say, look, you know, what can we do around here to reduce the sense of pressure everybody seems to be feeling?
What about the person giving that order to relax? Are they sometimes saying something else?
It depends on the nature of that person. A narcissistic person, as I mentioned, may just be annoyed that somebody else is doing something they don't like, and they may basically be saying, you know, I don't like the way you're making me feel. Cut it out. And other bosses are genuinely dismayed, but maybe don't have the social skills to open up the conversation in a way that will actually help. One experienced dentist I talked to says he never tells his patients to relax. Instead, he just says, you know, how are you feeling about this procedure today? And they start talking, and inevitably what he wants to happen happens. They relax.
Thanks, Sue. Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger with this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka. 21 minutes now after the hour. On this weekend. Thanks for being with us. Many believe the coming years in the automotive industry will be defined by self-driving vehicles. As part of that, Ford Motor Company has announced that it plans to have autonomous vehicles on the road by 2021, trying to keep up with competitors. As part of that undertaking, Ford is doubling the size of its staff in Palo Alto, California, to more than 300 employees. More on what's happening in this space from tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group. Rob, what about Ford?
Yeah, well, Ford's promising to have cars mostly for services like Uber in 5 years. These cars will not have steering wheels. They won't have gas pedals and brakes or shifters or any of the rest. They'll basically be horizontally rolling elevators, and they'll be part of the Uber or Lyft service. And, of course, both those services are arguing you won't need cars at that particular point in time. You'll just use one of these services and either subscribe to it or pay per ride. And you'll find it a much cheaper experience. And Ford wants to make sure if this happens, that they're part of that conversation and they're not knocked out of business.
How about the impact of an announcement like this or plans like this on, say, the tech and automotive industry?
Well, it's 5 years out. And remember that both of these industries tend to operate under a 12 to 18 month horizon. So it's great to talk about it. But anything that's 5 years out is, at least in this market, is considered to be pretty much blue sky.
Okay.
Because, you know, who knows what's going to happen with regard to regulation? Who knows what's going to happen with regard to the technology as it comes to market? As I say, the current model is that they're operating under has services like Uber and Lyft kind of taking over for ownership of cars for most of us. but who knows if that's actually going to happen in the 10 years it would probably take to completely roll this out. So at the end of the day, it's an interesting announcement, but until we get a lot closer, it's not really all that meaningful. And other car companies have different ideas how to do this. For instance, Toyota is looking at both this self-driving model where the driver has no input and something called Guardian Angel, where the driver would still be able to drive the car, but the computer would jump in at the car if the driver got into trouble and keep them from having an accident, or if the car noticed that the driver was inebriated or otherwise compromised, it could take over completely from the driver and disable the steering wheel pedals and get the driver home or to a hospital safely, like, for instance, if they were having a heart attack. That probably is a more reasonable spread, where you get cars that are like horizontal elevators for services, but cars that at least allow you to sort of pretend like you're driving if you want to buy one for yourself.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the tech advisory firm The Enderle Group, about Ford planning to roll out autonomous vehicles by the year 2021 and expanding its staff in Palo Alto, California, and Silicon Valley to more than 300 employees. I thought it was interesting, too. I think it might have been the head of Ford who said something along the lines of, if Ford's transitioning to actually like a mobility company, not necessarily a different kind of automotive company.
Exactly right. They're making a big pivot. Now, if you think about it, we have all these conversations about gun control and all the rest of the stuff, but a lot of people are killed in automobiles. In fact, a mammoth number of people are killed in automobiles. And if we can get people out of the cars and let computers take over, the theory is we can drop deaths in cars by better than 98%. And that's significant. So there's a lot behind this in terms of saving lives, because, the drunk driver doesn't necessarily kill himself. He tends to take out a family and kids, or a friend of mine's grandfather was run over by one. So it's that collateral damage that we're trying to mitigate as a nation. So with that in mind, Ford recognizes that with this future and life-saving in place, that maybe they need to become a very different car company in order to survive. And it's not a bad idea. It's just the question of whether car buyers themselves will go in for this, elevator-like service experience and not want to continue to drive. I think Toyota's approach to the market's a bit more reasonable. But here's the issue with the Toyota approach is, once the human is put back into the equation, then the probability of an accident goes up dramatically. And the insurance companies are really talking about a mammoth difference in terms of insurance for a self-driving car, an autonomous vehicle, versus a vehicle where a human has any interaction whatsoever. I mean, up to a 9x difference in terms of insurance costs. Jeez. So, if you're talking about, now you get a choice between driving a car or having the car drive you, and the difference in cost is, say, $15,000 a year if you're driving the car and $100 a year if you're not, that probably is going to drive a certain amount of behavior. So we'll see how this plays out.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of The Enderle Group. It is 30 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Trips to the post office, as you know, are never convenient. So why not get postage right from your desk with Stamps.com? Stamps.com even gives you special postage discounts you can't get at the post office, including first class, priority mail, express, international, and more. You'll never pay full price for postage again. Here's how Stamps.com works. Using your own computer and printer, you buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package. Then just hand it to your mail carrier or drop it in a mailbox. It's that easy. No wonder over 600,000 small businesses are already using Stamps.com. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. A 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Get started with Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Deal. That's Stamps.com. Enter Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka coming up this half hour. Why golf is not as popular as it used to be. Also, rising box office numbers are masking the glut of big-budget film flops, and the daily habits of Olympic athletes that you and I might adopt. That story in about 20 minutes. Well, we're seeing two different extremes right now involving Mother Nature: the massive and deadly flooding in southern Louisiana and the fierce wildfires burning in California. Time to talk preparedness now with Dr. Joe Alton, disaster prep expert. Joe, what about in Louisiana?
Wow, in Louisiana, there are 20 different parishes, that's what they call their counties over there, that are in the federal disaster zone, 40,000 homes damaged, only 9,000 flood insurance claims that are expected. That means that three-quarters of those homes may not be able to be repaired. There may not be funds for it.
Wow. All right, so in the event that this is going to happen again, or perhaps get worse from where it is now, what are you telling folks? How do folks in these low-lying areas get prepared, Joe?
Well, some of the things that are very important are, number one, have a weather radio. NOAA has a weather radio that is something you definitely need to have. When you hear from the authorities that it's time to evacuate, do not hesitate. Hit the road, Jack. That is the most important thing, Gordon, that you really, really need to do. Now, that doesn't mean that you just go anywhere. You go towards the highest ground that's possible. Usually there are flood evacuation routes that you'll see in a lot of these areas that are low-lying, and so that's one thing you need that's going to be very important. Beware of down power lines. This is very important. There are a lot of people that wind up getting electrocuted. Some of the deaths occur as a result of that, and even worse, when people walk into water that is electrified by a down power line.
Oh, yeah.
And they get in trouble, then their family members, friends, or other bystanders try to help them, and they get electrocuted as soon as they step in the water themselves.
Wow. All right, so, you know, it's interesting because you mentioned hit the road, right? Find someplace higher to go. Yet in California, I heard a report this morning that some folks are evacuating, but there's so many, right? 80,000 in that area of, I think it's called Wrightwood, where, like, motels are booked. People can't even find a place. They got to keep driving.
Oh, yeah, it's murder over there. And the funny thing about it is that fire goes faster uphill. So going to higher ground isn't necessarily going to help you in a wildfire because, well, hot air rises, right? And so if you're going uphill, you're going to higher ground, then you could easily wind up in an area that where the fire is spreading more quickly. This Blue Cut fire is amazing. It started off on Tuesday as 5 acres and went to like 25,000, 30,000 acres in just a day and maybe a little bit more. It's just amazing how fast and how intense. Some people say over there that they've never seen anything like it.
Well, we're speaking live this morning with Dr. Joe Alton, disaster prep expert, about what's happening in Louisiana and California. Why is it that these surveys, Joe, continue to show that Americans really don't prep as much as they should?
You know why? Because I think that, and I'm going to admit this, that the chances that the average person is going to be hit by a major disaster is going to, over the course of a year, let's say, it's pretty small. But what people don't realize is that the chances over the course of a lifetime, over their children's lifetime, maybe not so small. So maybe we should instill a culture of preparedness into the United States so that more and more people are prepared and we wind up having less deaths and less damage possibly in the future.
Preparing for flooding different from preparing for an approaching wildfire, or are the basics the same?
Well, the basic thing is to hit the road, and so that is actually the same. Now, of course, for flooding, if you can put together sandbags and put it in front of areas that you believe that there's going to be an opening for water to get into your home, that's one thing. With wildfires, you want to put together a defensible space. And when I say that, I want you to manage vegetation, especially dead vegetation, so that there isn't any within 30 feet of your building structure. If you can do that, then it's going to be much more difficult for the fire to have enough fuel to really get to your home.
Thanks, Joe. Dr. Joe Alton, disaster prep expert. It is 20 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Are you planning to squeeze in a round of golf this weekend? So one thing you might notice, you won't have much company. This morning, Sean Griffin, our contributing intern, spoke with MarketWatch reporter Katie Burke on why we're not golfing as much anymore.
For the past 5 years, the golf industry has seen kind of a slow in growth, both in participation and private club memberships. And that's been a factor, or it's been caused by a variety of factors, but kind of mostly influenced by a lack of discretionary income, lack of leisure time and kind of this movement away from a corporate world where deals are done on the golf course or over lunch and three martinis to kind of this 24/7, always on the go, always talking, always connected kind of business atmosphere.
Okay. So how much have the integration of smartphones and also to less face-to-face interaction play a role in the current trend we're seeing?
Yeah, well, I mean, when you go out and play 18 holes of golf, I mean, traditionally courses wouldn't let you bring your phone, and it's very, you are on the green and you are with the people you're with. But that doesn't really jive with how we do business now. You're talking to a million people at once. There's always emails coming in, always things you need to respond to. So, I mean, it just doesn't make sense anymore to take business to places like golf courses. And now, I mean, there's been a trend, and it's still pretty small, of people in finance taking clients to kind of more fitness activities like CrossFit or spin classes and just kind of things where you can get things done but still be connected and still get your client or whoever you're doing business with out of the office.
So how much, if at all, are country clubs worrying about the loss of business, or are they finding new ways to adapt?
Yeah, so now the millennial generation is kind of beginning to enter the age group where they would start to join country clubs, but they're not looking for the same thing that Gen X and the boomers wanted out of their country club experience. I mean, they want to be able to take their whole family there, spend the whole day there, because they don't have the luxury of leaving their family for an entire day. Families are beginning to share household duties more evenly, so it doesn't make sense for one person to just go off. So country clubs are trying to adapt to this by renovating their pool areas, having more casual dining areas for the kids so you don't have to dress them up every day, and kind of make sure they're on their best behavior. So it's easier to just kind of spend all this time there, and everyone is happy.
We are speaking with Market Watch reporter Katie Burke. She has a piece titled "Why Golf Has Gone the Way of the Three Martini Lunch." So, Katie, have these changes worked at all? Because I know that you had mentioned in your piece that country club revenue has only gone up about 1% annually over the last 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely too early to tell if the country club changes themselves are catching on, but the behavior they're trying to capture has definitely become more popular. And at the same time, their revenue growth has slowed. Revenue growth of driving ranges and kind of other fast entertainment venues has increased. So, I mean, places like Topgolf, mini golf have become more popular and kind of easy to go in and out and make sure everyone is entertained in some form or another.
So could the loss in business also be explained to a lack of popularity now with the game of golf?
Yeah, I mean, another factor people have cited is there's a lack of a golf superstar right now. I mean, golf got really popular in the 90s and 2000s when Tiger Woods was really at his peak. And then, I mean, now with all the scandal he's been involved with and he's getting older, he's not as much as the superstar he used to be, and there hasn't really been anyone to replace him. So, I mean, other sports have kind of taken over and become more popular among spectators, and I mean, kids are taking up kind of basketball, soccer, those kinds of fast-paced sports more than golf.
Also, too, what will happen if, say, we don't see a resurgence with the country clubs, I guess, generally speaking?
Yeah, I mean, people within the industry are pretty optimistic that this trend will turn around. There is a possibility that it's stuck back in the three martini lunch era, and those golf courses might just turn into real estate developments and people will go to driving ranges instead. I mean, it sounds pretty grim, and I hope it doesn't happen, but I mean, that's always a possibility.
Market Watch reporter Katie Burke with Sean Griffin, our contributing intern to This Morning, America's First News. It's 12 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Whether traveling or working remotely, we know your PC is your business headquarters. And when work takes you on the go, you need a laptop that can keep up. Dell's XPS 13 empowers small business owners to collaborate anywhere with incredible battery life and powerful performance. Reduce downtime by 50% and boost productivity with 4 times faster performance when you refresh to new Dell PCs featuring Intel Core processors. Explore the XPS 13 at Dell.com/radio. Thanks for being with us. The final big budget movie of the summer hits theaters this weekend, the $100 million film Ben-Hur. Will it be a hit? Well, the odds are against it. Wall Street Journal reporter Ben Fritz says there have been 15 big-budget disappointments or flops so far this year, compared with 8 at the same point last year. Those numbers, despite the fact that we've spent more on movies overall this year. Ben, what do we have?
Well, yes, I noticed that on the one hand, the total box office receipts are up slightly this year, domestically and around the world. You would think that's good news for Hollywood. But, you know, from talking to people at the studios, I can tell this has been a very tough year, a tough summer. So I looked into it. And the reason, very clearly, is the studios are releasing a lot more big-budget movies, big-budget sequels and reboots that have, because they cost a lot, have very big box office ambitions. So essentially, you have more movies that are competing for about the same box office dollars, only slightly more than last year. So the result, when you have more supply and about the same demand, is more flops.
All right, so which ones have flopped this summer?
Oh, it's a long list, but among the movies that have either flopped or have been disappointments, at least, you've got Warcraft, you've got Alice Through the Looking Glass, Independence Day Resurgence, Ghostbusters, The Legend of Tarzan, Star Trek Beyond, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2. I could go on and on, but wow. there's a few.
All right, so most, I think, as you point out, cost more than $100 million, some closer to $200 million. In terms of, technically speaking, regarding flops, that means they have not earned that money back?
Right. Now, I mean, most movies don't earn all their money back at the box office, but, they're not even, because they earn more money from DVDs and sales to HBO or Netflix and that kind of thing. But you can tell from a box office performance if a movie can ultimately make money, and these movies are all on a path to be losers, whether small losers or big losers.
Which ones have done well, by the way?
Yeah, there's been a handful of movies that have done well. In fact, what's interesting is the hits are major hits. Five movies have taken 30% of the box office this year. So what happens these days is if a movie's popular, it sort of gets into the zeitgeist and everybody wants to see it. So the few blockbusters we've had this year are Finding Dory, the sequel to Finding Nemo, Captain America Civil War, Deadpool, The Jungle Book, and Zootopia. Those are the biggest hits so far.
Okay. We're speaking with Ben Fritz. He covers the entertainment business for the Wall Street Journal. He's got a story entitled Rising Box Office Masks Glut of Big Budget Film Flops. Are we in a phase where it is time to rethink the successful movie formula?
Well, it's different. I think it would be good if the entire industry could all cut back on the big budget sequels and reboots. It would be good. The problem is, it's not rational for any one studio to cut back when all the rest are still doing it. Mm. Then you're just going to be the one studio that doesn't have big sequels to appeal to audiences. But if everybody were to produce fewer and make some more original movies, and those were more the kind of options audiences were presented with, it would probably be good for everybody. But I don't think we're going to see that happen. It's the kind of thing where it's kind of like a nuclear arms race. It's tough to be the first one to disarm.
Thanks, Ben Fritz, Wall Street Journal reporter, 6 minutes in front of the hour. You know, athletes at the Olympic level take their habits and routines very seriously. Fun story from the Daily Muse about some of their habits. Cassidy Cook from USA Diving. The day prior to competition, she takes an ice bath to ensure her legs are fully rested. Novak Djokovic, Serbian tennis star. Large cup of room temperature water, 2 tablespoons of honey, and a breakfast comprised of oatmeal, nuts, seeds, fruit, coconut oil, maybe coconut water. On a related note, Misty May Trainer, USA Volleyball, never misses breakfast. Scrambled egg with veggies is common. Michael Phelps, USA Swimming, each night he sleeps in a special altitude chamber. Similarly, Usain Bolt, fastest human in the world, his number one priority is sleep. And reemphasizing the importance of sleep, Kenyan runner Eliud Kipchoge, 1 hour nap every day, in bed at night by 9. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Need a website? Why not do it yourself with Wix.com? No matter what business you're in, Wix.com has something for you. Used by more than 84 million people worldwide, Wix.com makes it easy to get your website live today. You need to get the word out about your business. It all starts with a stunning website. With hundreds of designer-made, customizable templates to choose from, and the drag-and-drop editor, there is no coding needed. You don't need to be a programmer or designer to create something beautiful. You can do it yourself with Wix.com. Wix.com empowers business owners to create their own professional websites every day. When you're running your own business, you're bound to be busy. Too busy. Too busy worrying about your budget. Too busy scheduling appointments. Too busy to build a website for your business. And because you're too busy, it has to be easy, and that's where Wix.com comes in. With Wix.com, it's easy and free. Go to Wix.com to create your own website today. The result is stunning.